Welcome to the Code Newbie Podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and I want to tell you about our incredible sponsors, like Udacity. When they first approached us and told me about their programs, I thought to myself, if I could design an online learn-to-code experience, it would look a lot like what Udacity has to offer. They work with real tech leaders like Google and GitHub to design their courses, which are all online, project-based, and self-paced. And with their nano degree programs, you get one-on-one coaching and as many code reviews as you want. They've got programs for Python, JavaScript, Ruby, Java, Swift, and HTML and CSS. And all their tracks are designed to help you get career ready. And they're giving our Code Newbie community a special discount. You can get 50% off of your first month if you go to udacity.com/codenewbie. Mobile app development can be complex, but integrating your payments no longer has to be. With Braintree, your business can accept nearly every type of payment from any device with just one integration. Learn more at braintreepayments.com/codenewbie. Now, before we start the show, I also want to say that we are having our very first and hopefully our last Code Newbie logo contest. So we are offering $200 worth of services from our friends at Linode, a free nano degree program from our friends at Udacity, and if we pick your logo, $250 cash prize from us. So if you want to submit your logo, it can be an SVG, it can be a JPEG, it can be a PNG, it can even be just a scanned image of something that you sketched that you thought was a good idea. You can send it to us at hello@codenewbie.org with the subject line Code Newbie Logo Design Submission. You can enter by Friday, July 29th. So get your designs in and maybe you'll see your logo as our new Code Newbie logo. And our final announcement is that we have been added to the NPR One app, which is really exciting. It's a really great podcast listening tool, and it's available on iPhone, for Android, for Microsoft. So if you get a chance, we'd love for you to download it. And the great thing about it is that if we get even a couple hundred people to listen to the Code Newbie podcast on that app, we get a lot of feedback and data on what episodes you liked, what you didn't like, and it really, really help us out in making even better content for you. So download the NPR One app and search for Code Newbie Podcast and listen to us like you usually do. Today on the show, I'm so excited to have developer and speaker Nicholas Means. Nicholas, you want to say hi?
Hey, everybody.
I'm so excited to have you on the show. We met at RailsConf this year, which I enjoyed. I hope you enjoyed as well.
I did.
So you gave one of the keynotes. It was an awesome keynote, and it was called The Original Skunkworks. And what I loved about this talk is the fact that it talked about airplanes, and it was a very non-obviously technical talk that ended up being very profound and very relevant to code. So tell us a little bit about what that talk was about.
So the premise of my talk was on Lockheed Martin's Skunk Works, which is the Advanced Projects Division of Lockheed Martin, where they built planes like the U-2 and the SR-71 Blackbird and the F-117. And there were kind of two points to the story that tied it back into software. One was they built these planes with very small staffs and very lightweight processes. And a lot of times we have more process than we need in software. A lot of times we spend a lot of time in our day-to-day work bending our work to the process, not making the process fit our work. And the other point that I made in the talk is that a lot of times we can hack our way around unimportant things if we just focus on the most important things about the project that we're building. A great example is on the U-2. Weight was everything on the U-2. It needed to go 70,000 feet to get above Russian radar. And in order to do that, they put very non-traditional landing gear on it because it just didn't matter.
So if I were going to do a talk about planes and code, I would try to find some example where there was some extraordinary piece of code that was used in some awesome plane, and that would be how I put it together. I would never think about process or think about focus, which seem very just, again, non-obvious to me. How did you make the connection of planes and coding and not make it really about the tech or the technology behind it, but make it about the way the planes were built?
It's hard for me to answer because my brain's just always kind of done that. I spend a lot of time reading about things that aren't software. So that's probably part of it. I spend a lot of time taking in background knowledge. I tend to go on Wikipedia safaris a lot, especially if I'm reading about a plane crash or something like that, because there's always those handy links at the bottom of the article to read about other similar plane crashes. And, you know, 2 hours later, I look up and it's time for dinner. So I think spending a lot of time taking in information outside of the world of software helps you start seeing those connections and seeing, oh, well, the way that they hacked their way around this problem reminds me of this thing that we did in the last project that I worked on.
I think it's important because I think that especially for code newbies who are really, really excited about code and really excited about technology, you immerse yourself in this world and the only thing you read and sleep and tweet and breathe is tech. But it sounds like you have drawn a lot of inspiration and knowledge and ideas from non-technical things. So I think that's a nice reminder that having that balance can actually help your perspective and what you, you know, how you code and inform that side of things too.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, I think it's easy to get on that treadmill where you always have to be constantly learning the next new technology that comes out. You know, Justin Searles gave a great talk at RailsConf on the idea that Rails is kind of boring technology right now, but it's great boring technology and that it lets us solve a lot of problems with known patterns where you don't have to stay on that treadmill constantly always having to pick up the next new thing. But I think that's important beyond the scope of tech. I think you need to take in information from all scopes of life.
So we've had, I think, 2 podcast episodes so far around the subject of speaking and conferencing and talking at conferences. And the 2 that we've had were focused on the CFP and how to find a good conference to go to and really about how to leverage the speaking and conference experience for your tech career. But what I found since having those episodes and since just encouraging a lot of people in my network to speak is they'll get really excited and they'll say, yes, I want to talk. You know, I believe you. I think it would be really good for me. But now what do I talk about? And I think that the original Skunkworks, and then you also did another talk similar, has a plane theme to it, which is how to crash an airplane, I believe. These are just such interesting topics. And I'm wondering, how can we, besides kind of reading things that aren't always about software and aren't always code related, how can we find these interesting topics? What advice do you have for that?
So James Altucher speaks a lot about idea generation. And one of the things that he says is the best way to have good ideas is to have a lot of ideas. And so you really have to spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, what things am I interested in? What do I know a lot about? And okay, within those vectors of thought, what are some interesting ways I might be able to tie that knowledge back into software development? What are some interesting conclusions I might be able to reach?
So in that, and so I was one of the, I was on the programming committee for RailsConf, and so I got to see a lot of the talks. And I've seen that a lot of people who try to do that, it sounds very contrived. It sounds like it's very similar to, you know, how coding is like making a sandwich, or, you know, it's some kind of just very, very arbitrary connection that just honestly just sounds the same talk after talk. But your connection is just very, very authentic and very deep. What in your mind is the difference between something that feels very forced and kind of making a connection for the sake of making one and one that actually does have very important message behind it?
Well, I don't think people there's not many people out there that care passionately about making sandwiches, right? So I think one of the keys is to pick something that you really are passionate about and you really do enjoy learning about. I mean, one of the reasons that I gave the talk on United Flight 232 at RubyConf, and one of the reasons I picked Skunkworks for RailsConf is because those were both things that, frankly, I wanted an excuse to read more about. I wanted to be able to dig deeper into. So they were both things that I was already very passionate about and cared a lot about learning about.
I think one of the other problems that I've heard from people who, again, are interested in speaking but haven't quite made the leap yet is feeling like they don't really know about anything, or feeling like everything they know is obvious, and so why would you ever give a talk on it? Everyone knows all this stuff too. Are those ever correct thoughts, in your opinion?
So actually, on the way to RailsConf this year, I got stuck at Dallas Love Field on a long layover, and I was sitting in the airport Chili's talking to Brandon Hayes about this very thing, about how it seems like the points that I had to make in my talk, I was kind of worried because they seemed too obvious to me. And one of the things Brandon said to me is, you know, people need to hear the obvious again. And I think he's right. I think it's really easy to write stuff like this off as obvious and not give it the thought that it's due. I also think that when you take an otherwise obvious thought and you tie it to story in a way that resounds with people's emotions, it has a way of resonating in ways that it might not have resonated before. It might make sense for the first time when you tie it to a story that is completely unrelated to the original context of the thought.
And that's generally the advice that I give to people too, especially around the story, because I think that anytime you can tie it to a narrative, you can put it on some type of a path, it instantly just becomes more interesting and more memorable. And yeah, I think that's a very, very valid point. Is there a level of expertise? Because that's also another big thing that comes up too, is I know about this, but I don't have the authority to speak on this topic. Is there a level of expertise that you think you should get to before speaking on a particular subject?
There are probably subjects that is true for, but by and large, I don't think that's the case. I think that by investing the time to develop a conference talk, you've probably done more research into a given subject than most people have spent thinking about that particular subject. You earn your own expertise in building the talk.
Mm. Oh, I like that. That's a good quote. So let's say you have this idea, right? It's awesome. It's obvious, but you have a great story behind it. I want to talk about how you actually construct the talk. What is the first thing that you would do?
Read and read and read some more. I spend probably 70-80% of my talk prep time just reading, taking in all the information that I can.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I end up, as I'm reading, I'm taking notes on all the things that I'm reading, all the things that I, you know, the neat details that I might want to use in a talk. And I'm specifically looking for details, right? Because that's what gives you credibility as a storyteller. Anybody can tell you the general story of how the SR-71 was built, anybody that knows aviation. But digging into those stories, getting the details about the two Buick V8 Wildcat engines that they hooked to the turbine to get it started, and why that's the case, being able to tell that is what gives you credibility as a storyteller. So once I've sought those details out, then I go and I start looking for the story arc, the thing that's going to get me from the introduction all the way to the point in the talk where I transition to start tying it back into software.
So how many hours do you end up spending on the research and the reading part of things?
Oh, goodness. Probably somewhere on this talk, probably somewhere between 60 and 80 hours.
Wow, that's a long time.
I spend a lot of time on my talks, yeah.
Wow. I mean, you can tell when you were talking about the details, that was the thing that stood out to me the most. You know, I feel like the big points, the takeaways and all that, you can probably get from reading a blog post or just a really good article, but the level of detail that you went into and talking about the human dynamics of the key players and what they try and how they, I mean, that level of detail really, that was the thing that made it just very, very different and gave it, like you said, gave yourself a lot of credibility and made you come off as the expert. I don't know if you are or not. I know you love planes, but you know, if that was the only thing you knew about planes, I would believe you've been doing this for years.
Yeah, I do love planes. Yeah, so it is a lot of research. But I was talking to my wife about this. I came into programming as a hobby. I did it as a hobby for a long time before it transitioned into a career.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked up one day and realized I was doing software for a living and I no longer had a hobby.
Mm.
And I'd been thrashing around trying to find a hobby. And as I was writing this talk for RailsConf, it suddenly dawned on me that writing conference talks has legitimately become my hobby.
Interesting. Huh. So is that something that you would do even if you didn't have a particular conference to go to? Like you just kind of write them and hopefully someone will pick it up?
I kind of do. I spend a lot of time, I don't necessarily commit it to paper, but I spend a lot of time thinking through the next few talks that I might want to give.
So we talked about the research phase and then getting really into the details and finding that connection between the topic and the coding thing that you want to explore and making sure there's a nice connection there. What are some things that you've seen in other talks that you recommend people avoiding or not doing or that you've seen just haven't really worked out very well?
I think for me, it all comes back to story. It doesn't matter how technical the talk you're going to give is. If you don't find a way to hang it on the bones of a good story arc, you're going to have a hard time engaging your audience and keeping them tuned in for your entire talk. heard a great stat the other day that the human mind spends somewhere around 30% of the time daydreaming, except when it's engaged in a story. If you're being told a story, your brain will not daydream. It will be engaged in what it is hearing.
Hmm, interesting. So how do you feel about the talks that are top 10 things to do in RSpec, or those kinds of listicle style talks? How do you feel about those?
You know, it's funny. I actually, when I go to conferences, I tend to stay away from that kind of talk altogether. I consider myself a bit of a soft talk aficionado, just because it seems like when you go to a conference and you sit down for 40 minutes of drinking from a fire hose in a technical talk, there's usually not a lot that you're going to take away from that beyond a curiosity to dig deeper about the topic. And sometimes that's worthwhile. But when you go to a soft talk and you hear a story or you hear some concept about how the brain works and how it ties into programming, that tends to be more impactful for me. And so that's kind of fed into the kind of talks that I like to give.
And so I think that the technical talks are, they just feel like a whole other category of talk where I think it's a lot harder to create a narrative around because there's just so much technical material that you want to get through. And there's, you know, code samples and a bunch of other things. So do you have any advice on how to use code samples effectively and how to leverage the storytelling that we've talked about so far, but also deal with that, you know, fire hose of information when it comes to technical topics?
You've got to find your angle. I gave a refactoring talk to convince myself that I could give technical talks. And I did it based on Strunk and White's Elements of Style. And I took one of the first pieces of Rails code that I wrote. It was about a thousand line model that I pulled out of this application and picked one or two methods to refactor my way through. But it gave me the skeleton to tell sort of the story of my career and how I came to write this code and how I still maintain it to this day. So even in the midst of a technical talk, you still have to give the audience tidbits of story here and there to keep them tied into what you're saying and to keep them engaged with why what you're telling them is important.
Yes, and that reminds me of a technical talk that I really, really love that Katrina Owen did at Bath Ruby last year called Here Be Dragons. And it was a technical talk in that it had code samples and it had a lot of code samples, but the way that she told it was saying, you know, I took this code that someone else had written and there was an issue and I was trying to debug it. And the whole talk was about that debugging process and her slowly trying different things and trying other things and getting stuck and hitting a wall, then taking a step back. And, you know, she took us on this journey of all the different things that she had to do to finally figure out what this issue was and to solve it. And in the process of going through that, she touched on different, you know, principles around debugging and different ways that she does things, almost without really saying that she was doing it. She showed us how she was doing it. And then at the end, you walked away with a kind of a higher level, more touchy-feely takeaway. But to me, it was just really incredible to see someone do such a technical talk with just so many coding elements to it, but still have it be, as you said, you know, around a story that you could follow. So that even if you had no idea what any of the code was saying, you were still incredibly invested in her figuring it out at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the thing I know about Katrina Owen is how much time she spends prepping her talks. She puts so much time and attention into carefully crafting every slide that she puts into her talks and everything that she says in her talks. I love the way that she builds talks like that.
Mm-hmm. So now I want to talk a little bit about delivery, because I've, you know, after seeing all the abstracts and the CFPs that came into RailsConf and then looking at that and thinking about how it actually was presented, there's such a big difference, right? You read a talk and you think, oh, this is going to be a very serious one. And then you see the presenter and it comes off a little silly in a good way, you know, silly and lighthearted, and then vice versa. And I'm wondering, what has your experience been on the actual speech delivery part of things?
So I first started speaking back in high school. I did competitive extemporaneous speaking, which is where you draw a couple topics, pick one of them, and then you have about 30 minutes to go and research and write a 7-minute speech. And then you go and deliver that speech to 3 judges. And I probably did that over 100 times while I was in high school. So I had a lot of practice at removing the uhs and the ums from my speech and refining my pacing and figuring out how to vary my vocal intonation to make sure that I got attention on the parts of the speech that I wanted to get attention to.
So what are some ways that we can do that?
Probably the easiest thing to try, and also one of the scariest things to try, is to ask somebody to sit there with a piece of paper as you're giving a speech and count your uhs and ums. And the number, if you've never focused on it before, if you've never worked on trying to get them out of your speech, it'll be a surprisingly high number.
There is an app, I wish I remember the name of it. There's an app that a friend of mine has where it counts your ahs and ums, but also looks at filler words. And so I think you get to, pick, it has like a list of possible filler words, and you get to kind of pick the ones that you know you're guilty of. And as you talk into it, and it records the number, and it gives you a little little report at the end. It's kind of depressing, and you get to see a lot of the, because they're filler words that don't feel like filler words. For me, it's you know. I love a good you know. My other filler word is nice. When I just kind of like don't really know how to say things, I'll just say nice. It's nice and neutral. And so those are definitely things I'm guilty of. And that app really, really helps with that. One thing that I remember when I was giving a talk at, where was it? It was in Arizona a year ago. It was a Dev Intersection Conf. That's what it was. And when I gave a talk there, I was sitting with Scott Hanselman, and he was giving me advice on how to speak, and specifically on different tools and techniques I can use to emphasize certain points, draw attention to certain things. And when I think about speaking, I'd always, before that conversation, I'd always thought of my goal as a speaker to remove any issues with my speaking. So not doing the ahs and ums, not, you know, gesturing too wildly, which sometimes I do, or, you know, not putting my weight on one hip, things like that that just detract from the talk. But until that conversation, I didn't think about things I could do to enhance the talk. So what are some things that you do that actually make the talk, you know, that go from just a regular conversation to something that is almost a performance?
So one of the most important things to do is to vary pitch and pacing. If you think of those two things, they're very much the texture of your speech. So if you have just a plain piece of copier paper, you can print stuff on that copier paper and convey a message. But if you have a piece of linen parchment, you can print something on the linen parchment as well, and it's going to get a lot more attention, and you're going to engage it with different parts of your senses. So when you go and you give a speech and you vary your intonation, you vary your pacing, you vary your tone, you give the brain more texture to latch onto to engage with you as you're speaking.
So when we talk about varying your tone, what can I do if I want to highlight something? What exactly do I do with my tone to draw attention to something? Can you give me an example?
So for me, it's when I want to draw attention to a point, it's more that I slow down than anything I do with my pacing. It's that I'll draw out a word, or I'll add just a bit of pause to indicate that I'm about to say something important, and give everybody in the audience's brain a chance to catch up with what I've said so far and be ready for what it is that I'm about to say.
So you take a pause almost right before you say the big thing?
Yeah. I mean, and it's not even really, it's not going to be perceived by the audience as a pause. It's more of just a comma or a long hyphen.
Mm-hmm. One of the things also is just your inflection, right? I've heard so many talks that just always end on a question mark, which is not fun for the audience. But I do think that there are times when you can do different things with your voice that give off a certain feeling. And I'm wondering, for you, do you use that as a tool?
Probably not intentionally. It tends to be, I tend to get in the rhythm of storytelling and not think as much about that stuff, which is one of the reasons I tend to not script my talks out. I tend to give myself an outline so that I don't get lost, and so that if I do get lost, if my brain hiccups and I don't know where I am, I can recover pretty quickly. But I still prefer to speak mostly extemporaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And just to get up on stage and tell the story.
Oh, man, that sounds so risky. That's all you. I can't live life on the edge like that.
I can't do it scripted. I've done scripted things before, and it's really difficult for me to get my delivery to sound the way that I want it to sound.
Mm.
Even if I memorize a script, it still sounds, to my ears, it still sounds scripted.
Okay, so to be fair, I don't memorize my talk. So my process is I'll write out mostly everything word for word before I do my slides, before I, you know, assuming I have all my information together, I'll write out everything I want to say word for word, and I'll read it over and over and over and over and over until I've pseudo memorized it, you know, until I recognize that there are specific sentences that I definitely want to hit, right? Or a combination of words or a phrase that I want to make sure I say at this moment, right after this pause, at this tone, you know, and I'm very specific about that. And because I've just read it so many times and I've rehearsed it so many times, everything else I can do on the spot, you know, because I have the feel of the story pretty nailed down at that point. But there are definitely, and I found this to be true with my more recent talks, because I'm using fewer and fewer slides. So before, you know, I think the first talk I gave was actually at RailsConf, same RailsConf as you in 2014. And for that, I had a ton of, I don't remember how many, but I had a ton of slides. And so my slides were basically just my transitions, right? It would be my little prompt to go to the next thing. And now that I have a lot less slides, I have to be very purposeful about my words, because I'm counting on them listening to me and paying attention to me and not necessarily being engaged by the change in slides, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely it does. And I think I follow a similar process to you. I just don't script it out ahead of time because I do rehearse my talk a lot. But it's based on the notes. And by the time I get to the point that I'm ready to get on stage and give it, I'm probably saying 90% the same thing every time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's more that iterative process for me of sorting out what I want to say and how I want to say it is something that I do best verbally as opposed to typing it out on a keyboard. But I think the same thing still happens.
Yeah. And it's so nice when, you know, you hear yourself. For me, a big thing that I, again, just didn't really think very much about is the tone and the pausing, especially the talk that I gave most recently at OSCON. I used the crap out of pausing because there were definitely a few slides and a few points I really wanted to hit home. And I was so, so happy with how that ended up, you know, delivered. And that's something that I want to be more cognizant of as I, you know, continue to speak.
Yeah, well, you already brought up something that's really important to me, and that's using less slides and putting less words on the slides that you use.
Yes.
Because, you know, typical business school 101 is you should be able to read a slide deck and get the gist of what the presentation is about from reading the deck. And I could not disagree with that more.
Yeah.
If you can look at one of my slide decks and make any sense of it without me talking, I've done something wrong.
I'm so glad you feel that way. I feel exactly the same way. That's why I mean, putting my slides up on speaker deck or any of those, just there's no point because there's, and so for me, actually, the first talk I gave, I had a ton of cartoons, and my most recent talks, I don't have that many graphics in it. I'll just have a couple of words, or at most I'll have a sentence, and it's the one sentence that I want you to remember and I want to stick with you as I speak. You know, I always assume that things get tweeted. So if it gets tweeted, like that's the sentence that I want to be captured. And so, yeah, I use at most a few words. There are a couple times where I'll have a bulleted list if I'm talking about resources or things that is actually helpful to, you know, have straight names of. But yeah, I'm very, very, very minimal with my slides.
Yeah, my last two decks have been more visual than word heavy. I don't think there weren't many words in this last slide deck at all.
Right.
Just because for me, the slide deck is a way to get people into the story. It was even more important on the How to Crash a Plane talk, because one of the things that I wanted to do was to get people emotionally engaged with the people that were on that plane. And to do that, I needed to show the audience the inside of that plane. I needed to show them the cockpit so they could be in the cockpit with the flight crew. And so it was very much, I was using the visual imagery in the slide deck to help the audience engage with the story in their imaginations, in their minds, as I was telling it to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for those talks specifically, it makes a ton of sense that you would use a lot of imagery, right? If you're going to talk about planes, I want to know what they look like. And especially when you, I remember when you're talking about the weight distribution one and how they had to, I think it was, I can't remember if it's tilting on one side because it wasn't.
Oh, the
very,
U2, yeah. Yeah, it that lands one. And they just tip it over on the wing as it lands.
Right, yeah, that, I needed to see that because I would have had.
That video was my favorite part of that whole talk. I love that.
It was awesome, yeah. So the other, I think, very important part about giving a talk that people don't think about too much is what do you do with your body, right? Especially when you're keynoting, usually they'll give you a little lapel. Is that what it's called, a lapel lavalier?
Yeah.
And so you have the whole stage. Now you can move around, you can do jumping jacks, you can do whatever you want. And with that much freedom, it can be hard to figure out, you know, do you pace? Do you stand still? Where do you put your weight? What do you do with your hands? What did you learn when you were doing this competitive speaking? What did you learn about what to do with just your body while you talk?
So one of the big things is to not close yourself off, not to go into a fig leaf position, not to cross your arms.
What's a fig leaf position?
It's with both hands in front of your midsection.
Cool.
So when you do those things, you're taking on a defensive posture, which is the most natural thing in the world to do when you're on stage in front of a bunch of people, right?
Yes.
But when you do that, it's one of the things that subtly takes away from your credibility. Because the human mind is very adept at picking up on subtle cues like that.
Mm-hmm.
Back when I was doing competitive speech in high school, movement on stage has always been a struggle for me. And what we did back then was you move to a new position every time you made a new point.
Oh.
Well, that's pretty easy to do in a 7-minute speech because you're going to do an intro, 3 points, and a conclusion, and you're done. The same formula doesn't really work when you're giving a longer talk that doesn't necessarily have defined points.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's more, I don't want to be hiding behind the lectern. I want to be out as far as I can get into the stage so that I can engage with the whole room. Some of it depends on what part of the talk I'm in and how much of it I have in my memory. So, you know, you can watch the video of the Skunk Works talk and you can tell the parts that I'm really confident in because it's when I get real brave and I get a long way away from my laptop and my notes.
Oh, man, that's always my biggest fear is getting too far away from my laptop in case anything goes wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you know, it's so easy to lose your train of thought or lose your focus and need those notes right there so you can get it back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's risky.
So for me, it's more about making sure I'm talking to the entire room than it is emphasizing any particular points. But that's actually probably the area of my speaking that I want to grow most in right now is how to be a little bit more deliberate about how I present myself on stage, how I move around.
Mm-hmm. I remember in that conversation I mentioned with Scott, one of the things that he talked about was how to use gestures to kind of guide the audience from one point to another. So specifically the example he gave is he said that there was this very famous technical speaker, I can't remember his name, but that speaker would just do very purposeful visual gestures. So he'd say, you know, now that we've talked about this, let's move on to this other point. And when he would say this, he would literally point in front of him like he had a box and he'd say, we're going to talk about this. And then he would move that box physically to his side and step away from it. And when Scott, you know, performed this to me, I was like, oh man, I really like that. It's just the very literal visual representation of we have this point, we're going to move it aside. Okay, now let's keep going. And that's just something that, again, I would never have thought about.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I wouldn't either.
So I'm curious, when you're talking about the 7-minute speech and you're saying to move whenever you have a new point, is it that you move while you're making the second point or kind of you move and then make the point? I'm curious about how that would look in real life.
So what I would always do is move as I was making the transition, as I was wrapping one point up and moving to the next. It's the same sort of thing as the box technique you were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's the idea that you're moving from this one phase of your talk into this next phase and you're making a physical change to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. One thing that I realized is when I speak, I don't really pay attention to where I'm going. I just kind of do a soft pace. And what I'm trying to do now is to stand still when I'm making a serious point.
Mm-hmm.
Just to say, you know, stand still, weight evenly distributed, legs slightly open, pointing to the audience or gesturing to the audience and trying to, again, bring the focus back and not have it be so movie. I tend to move a lot when I talk.
Yeah. I wish there was a way to get your speaker's notes on the confidence monitor. So most conferences have confidence monitors at the bottom of the stage where you can see your slides in front of you without turning around and looking at the big screens. But it's just the image of your slide. It's the same thing the audience is seeing. So, you know, you're still tethered to your laptop to go see those notes.
Yep.
And so that makes it harder to do that sort of purposeful, effective movement unless you've got your speech, your talk completely memorized, which I never do.
Yeah, and that was the talk, because I knew that I wasn't going to have my speaker notes, and that was a talk where I had to memorize my, because it was the conclusion that I really wanted to hit home, and so I stood like right in the middle of the stage, and it stood still as I delivered, and it was the most nerve-wracking thing, because it was maybe 8 to 9 sentences, and I was like, oh my God, please don't mess up. It was, you know, when you speak and you hear yourself speaking, but you also hear yourself talking about the fact that you're speaking. So the sub voice is just, don't, I swear to God, Saran, don't mess this up. Don't do it. Don't do it. And so that was my experience with memorization.
Every time I've lost my place in a talk, that's been what's going on. It's been that internal loop just telling me how terrible I'm doing in this talk.
Yep, that sounds right. Oh, and my favorite is when I do really well on a particular part of the talk, and then the voice goes, yeah, you did it. Oh my God, that was so great. Wait, keep going. That voice is really distracting either way.
It is. It's very distracting, and it's so inaccurate.
Really. Just not helpful at all. So as people are listening, hopefully they're getting some ideas of how to connect, you know, coding topics with maybe not so coding things, and how to give an effective talk and how to deliver it and all that. Do you have any final words of advice, any final tips for people who are still a little bit hesitant, still not sure what to do for their first talk, but are very much interested in launching their technical speaking career?
So I think it's really important to think about the things that you feel that you know the most about, the things that you've spent the most time thinking about. When I was trying to get into conference speaking, for me, that was imposter syndrome. It was something I really struggled with early on in my career, because I spent 7 years as a solo developer, where I had nobody else on my team. Nobody was ever seeing my code. I really didn't have any way to gauge what caliber of software engineer I was, how good my code was. So I had intentionally taken a job at a company that I knew did 100% pair programming, just because I figured I might as well go and face the music and be drummed out of software engineering forever as an imposter, right? Well, that didn't happen. And I actually learned a lot about imposter syndrome along the way, and did some of my research on the topic of imposter syndrome, submitted a talk to RailsConf that turned into this strange meta talk about how I reacted psychologically to having my first conference talk selected to RailsConf.
That's awesome.
And so, I mean, for me, I didn't have any idea really that I was going into it doing a storytelling talk. It wasn't something I did on purpose, but the talk is very much a very personal story about how I reacted to being selected to give a conference talk at RailsConf. So don't be afraid that you're going to say something that's obvious or that you might not be the foremost expert on. Just go out there and find something that you think you know a lot about and can share about. And then do the research. And by the time you're done doing the research, you will have interesting things to share. You'll have things that people haven't thought of.
Yep, definitely. And by the way, that talk was so popular. I remember hearing about that talk and just seeing, you know, Twitter kind of blow up about it. And that's a very, very, very popular talk. So thank you so much for giving it. I think you helped out a lot of people feel a lot less alone in those feelings.
It's still got more views than any of my other talks, and I hope it stays that way.
So next, let's do some fill in the blanks. Are you ready?
I am.
Number one, worst advice I've ever received is?
Just keep your head down. You can't change the culture here.
Oh, I feel like there's a story behind that.
Yeah, I was working at a software engineering job that, for lack of a better way to put it, kind of had a jock culture thing going on. A lot of people arguing over technical ideas, a couple of really dominant voices in the room. And the advice that I got when I brought this up to other people within the organization is just keep your head down. You're not going to change those people. And they were right. I wasn't going to change those people.
Mm-hmm.
But I also didn't need to stay there.
Mm. Yeah. Number two, my first coding project was about
Egyptian history, actually.
Really?
Yeah. So I was in sixth grade and there was an Apple IIe at the back of our classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to have gone to a summer camp where I learned to code in BASIC. So I spent about 3 weeks after school hammering away on that computer in the back of the room writing this, I think it was a 20-question quiz on Egyptian history as a class project.
Nice. That's awesome. How did you do? Did you get a good grade?
I did get a good grade, yeah, because my teacher was sitting right there looking exactly how hard I was working on this thing. I mean, aww, teachers don't often get to sit there and watch how many hours their students are putting into a project.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you couldn't have done it at home because there's an Apple II there.
That's right. Yeah.
Number three, one thing I wish I knew when I first started to code is?
You don't have to love to code to be a great software engineer.
Oh, that is very interesting. Did you not love to code when you first started?
I didn't, and I still don't.
Really?
Yeah. So I spent the first several years of my career wondering if I'd chosen the wrong career path because I didn't spend all my spare time writing code and trying to learn stuff. I think it played pretty heavily into my imposter syndrome, right? Because I wasn't a real programmer. I didn't want to spend all my time with a computer writing code.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's always been a way to apply leverage to a problem and solve problems really efficiently. So I love the problem solving process of writing software, but I don't necessarily like the act of writing the software itself. It's just a great tool for me to get the job done.
Interesting.
And that's not to say I don't like programming. I do. It's just not something that I absolutely love and I want to spend as much time doing as I can.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah, we had Kate Donahue, I think it was a year ago, we had her on the show. And at the time she's working for MakerBot. And she said something similar to that where she said, you know, it's okay if you don't want to spend every hour coding. You know, it's perfectly fine if you want to go home at 5 o'clock when your job is done and you want to knit or cook or just do other non-coding things. And I think it's important to remember because in our community, there's kind of this idea that you should always be coding and always be reading. And if you do, that's fine. I'm definitely guilty of that. But if you don't, that's fine too. And it can just be, you know, a tool and a job and something that works.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I wouldn't have time to develop these kind of talks if I spent all my time in code.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. And we like those talks, so keep going with that.
Oh, thank you.
Keep them coming. So next, let's do some shout-outs. Do you have a couple for us?
I do. The first one is a book and a blog by Gar Reynolds called Presentation Zen. I actually read it between How to Crash a Plane and my most recent talk, and it affirmed a lot of things that I'd stumbled into kind of on my own, and it also gave me some further refinements to the way that I design my slide decks and the way that I structure my talks. He does a great job explaining exactly how you go about building minimalist slides and how you build slides that aren't just a wall of text.
Interesting. So what is there besides don't have a slide full of text?
There's a lot of subtle things that you can do about how you align images and the directions that they point. And, you know, one of the simple things that I did in my deck for the original Skunkworks is whatever direction the airplane was pointing, that's where I put the label, because that's where the audience's eye is going to flow naturally anyway.
Oh, that is awesome. Oh, I really like that. What's it called again?
Presentation Zen.
Presentation Zen. Okay, I'm going to look that up. One of the things that, I don't know if you, oh, you were at OSCON. So when Katrina Owen did her talk at OSCON, it was called, I think, The Bait and Switch of Open Source, and it was about her journey building Exorcism. And she did this cool thing where at the bottom, there were these, almost like these little bubbles. I don't know if she showed it to you when we were at RailsConf, but there were these little bubbles. And as she talked, they would start with just, you know, one or two bubbles all the way on the left. And as she talked, it's almost like a progress bar of her talk. She'd kind of add more bubbles to the bottom. And the bubbles were color coordinated with one of four types of points that she was making. And it was one of those really subtle, creative things that I didn't notice until she pointed it out. And I was like, holy crap, that's really cool. And it just, you know, kind of opened my eyes to, man, there might be some cool things I can do with my, besides just, you know, making them minimal and making them not distracting, but again, doing things that not only make sure that it's not bad, but making sure that it's better and that it enhances the experience. So that sounds like a great book to give me some more ideas.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I got a lot out of it.
Cool. What else you got?
Number two is DeckSet, which is this really great application that lets you build presentations in Markdown. And it has a set of design templates built in, so it will take your Markdown and turn them into a really pretty deck of slides.
Interesting.
And I should disclaim that I didn't use it for the original Skunk Works, at least for the final presentation. But I've fallen into this rhythm of always using DeckSet to do my rough draft. Because, you know, like I was telling you earlier, my process tends to be that I give the talk over and over and over again to refine it.
Mm-hmm.
And so being able to get that rough draft into a presentation tool really easily and being able to kind of stream of consciousness my way through the story narrative that I'm trying to lay out is a really productive way for me to be able to lay out a talk.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cool.
And it also keeps my perfectionist tendencies towards slide design out of the process.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. So the way I do my slides almost last. So I'll take that script that I told you about, and then from there I'll break it up and I'll say, okay, what slide needs to go with what? So this paragraph needs a slide. This one sentence needs its own slide, and I'll kind of assign it that way. And then I will copy and paste the different script parts onto a PowerPoint or a Keynote and just drop in the full script. And I will force myself to just practice, you know, the pacing and the flow of that without any final designs. And then the final, you know, the colors and the font and all that, that comes very, 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 very much at the end. Because if not, I'll get so caught up in, that's not the exact shade of burnt yeah. orange that I want. And then it, you know, it just all goes downhill from there.
Yep. Same for me. Only when I do, when I start in Keynote and that's where I build my slides, I did that for How to Code Like a Writer. And it was such a perfect procrastination mechanism.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's why, so I don't do as much cartooning in my talks as I used to, but if I think I'm going to, I will say, you will not make the cartoons until the very, very end. And by the time I get to the end, because that, you know, huge procrastination tool. And by the time I get to the end, usually I can either, you know, repurpose a cartoon I already had, or it turns out I just don't really need it to make the point, yeah. you know? So I've avoided a lot of time wasting that way.
Sweet. And I've got one more for you if we have time.
Yeah, go for it.
All right. So number three for me is not about presentations. This one is Alex Harms and the Little Guide to Empathetic Technical Leadership.
Oh.
So, you know, in my bio, I say that I think that most software development is human interaction. And this is probably the most concise book I've seen that sort of espouses what I mean when I say that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Conway's Law says that the software that we build is going to end up looking like the team that built it. And so it's very important that as you build your team out, you're building in things like empathy and compassion and taking care of each other. Because if you do that, you're going to be able to build software that does the same thing for your end users.
That is so interesting. I feel like I've heard of that law many years ago and just totally forgot about it. But thank you for bringing that up. That's very, very interesting.
Yeah, for sure. And one thing to point out about it is, the title does say it's empathetic technical leadership, but it's very applicable to everybody who does software development in a team. You definitely don't have to be in a formal leadership role for the things that Alex talks about to really make a difference in how you approach your everyday work.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So I've got a few sponsored shoutouts to start. If you're looking into being a Ruby on Rails developer, the first step is learning Ruby, and Udacity's got the program to get you started. Their Ruby programming nano degree program was designed with GitHub's very own internal subject matter experts. You'll get a solid understanding of the language before diving into the framework, use projects to apply your knowledge, and get all the code reviews you want. And one of those projects you get to work on is building your very own gem from scratch. And once you're done, you'll be ready for part two, the Ruby on Rails nano degree program. So go to udacity.com/codenewbie and sign up and get your first month 50% off. By next year, maybe even next week, there could be a whole new way to pay. Maybe it'll be the next Bitcoin or the next Apple Pay, or maybe even both. Fortunately, Braintree's full stack payment platform is easily adaptable to whatever the future holds, so you can adapt easily too. Accept everything from pounds to PayPal to that next big innovation, from any device with just one integration. And when that new payment method comes out, all you'll have to do is update a few lines of code. No late nights, no complicated recoding, no stress about staying ahead of the curve. Braintree Payments is here to help. Learn more at braintreepayments.com/codenewbie. That's braintreepayments.com/codenewbie. And I've got a couple personal shout outs. One is Callback Women, which if you don't know, is a really, really great Twitter handle to follow. And the website is just callbackwomen.com. And all they do is just tweet out open CFPs. And the intent and the idea is to promote diversity and get more underrepresented groups to speak. But really, if you just need to find out what the latest open CFP is, they keep a nice list of it and they're constantly tweeting new things out. So definitely keep an eye on that so you can submit to your next conference. The other one is a book called Present, A Techie's Guide to Public Speaking. And this is by Purnima Vijayashankar, who we actually had on the show maybe about a year ago. She is the founding engineer of Mint. And now she's the founder of Femgineer. And she does a bunch of stuff around product development and sales and marketing and things that a lot of technologists and programmers kind of need to be aware of. And public speaking is definitely one of those things where if you speak that, I mean, Nick, you can probably tell us yourself, but for me, it's helped my career a ton and it's helped me network and meet new people. And it's just been a really great tool. So if you're interested, check out Present. It's a really nice, succinct book. I think it's online. There's an ebook version of it. So check that out. And the final one I have is the speech app I mentioned earlier where it counts those filler words and those ums and ahs and that kind of thing. And it's called Ummo, U-M-M-O, Ummo. And it's an app. It's super easy to use. It's really nice. And I've used it. I've had a friend of mine who introduced it to me. He's used it too. And it's pretty good. So if you're looking to improve your delivery, try that out and let us know what you think.
Sweet.
If you want to join the conversation, you can join us on Code Newbie Discourse, our online forum for people excited about code, or you can chat with us every week on the Code Newbie Twitter chat. Just search for #CodeNewbie and tweet with us every Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You can learn more about that as well as show notes on this episode at codenewbie.org/podcast. If there's a topic you want to hear about or a guest you want to hear from, send us an email, hello@codenewbie.org. Thank you again, Nick, so much for joining us. You want to say goodbye?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Saran.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.